The skyline at sunset. Street musicians in Central Park. New York City is full of things that make people happy. That's why we were surprised by recent headlines that labeled the Big Apple the unhappiest city in the nation. Good morning. I'm George Bodarkey, and this is Cityscape on 90.7 FM and WFUV.org. This morning, we're taking a look at all things happy. But first, what about those unhappy headlines? On the phone with us is Professor Joshua Gottlieb from the University of British Columbia. He, along with a couple of Harvard researchers, authored the study that led to those news reports. So is it true? Is New York City the unhappiest city in all of America? Joshua, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
I'm very happy to be here.
So what did your study aim to find out?
We wanted to understand how living in different areas affects an individual's life satisfaction or happiness, and more generally, try to interpret what these happiness measures mean for economics.
What matters most when it comes to people's happiness?
Well, the first major conclusion that our paper reached is that the cities that experienced the largest population declines over the second half of the 20th century tend to have lower reported life satisfaction or happiness. So places like Detroit, Gary, Indiana, and much of the Rust Belt fit this pattern. Other things that matter are having an educated population, which is good for happiness, and having milder winters, which also improves the city's contribution to happiness.
Anything in those findings that surprised you?
We were struck by how much the decline mattered, and furthermore, that it doesn't seem to be a causal effect of the population decline. The cities that had low happiness related to declining populations also had lower happiness in their heyday, before the populations declined. And this helps us understand what these happiness measures really mean. We tend to find evidence that people have other objectives in life beyond just happiness, at least as we can measure it in surveys.
Such as what?
Well, people were moving to the declining cities even before they declined, and that was probably for jobs, for the great economic opportunities that a place like Detroit had back when it was the manufacturing center of the world, even though it had low happiness levels at that point. So people were willing to trade off the lower happiness for higher incomes and career opportunities and a chance to raise a family.
Many headlines recently read, New York is the nation's unhappiest city. But you told us in an email that that's an unfair interpretation of the results of your study.
The way we came up with these measures was by looking at individual responses to a large survey conducted by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta. So we took the answers to a survey question that the CDC asked. They asked 300,000 people a year nationally, in general, how satisfied are you with your life? We take people's answers to that question, which can range from very dissatisfied through very satisfied, and then adjusted them for individual demographic characteristics, because we want to make sure that we're comparing the effect of a city for comparable people. But you can do those adjustments in different ways. So you can adjust for income or not adjust for income, and New York comes out on the bottom if you adjust for income, which is to say, if you ignore New York's contribution to your income. But of course, New York has massive effects on job opportunities and income, and that might very well make people happier.
So then where would you say New York falls on this happy scale?
Well, it doesn't come out too positively with any of our adjustments, I have to tell you. It comes out at the bottom if you don't do any adjustments, and it's within the bottom 10 metropolitan areas, even when you do our preferred adjustments.
But people stay, and people say that they love it.
That's right, and that gets precisely back to our conclusion. People are moving to New York in droves and staying in New York and paying god-awful rents to live in New York because it has so much to offer, even outside of the happiness domain.
So where, then, are the happiest cities in the country?
The South tends to do well. Charlottesville, Virginia, came in at number one on our preferred ranking, and a number of places in Louisiana come in towards the top as well. You won't be surprised to hear that Hawaii tends to do pretty well also.
Joshua, who can learn most from a study like this?
Well, we think that this study has important implications for policymakers who have recently taken to measuring happiness data and trying to understand how well they're doing on the basis of these types of surveys. Our research suggests that that is a misguided effort. And this is precisely because people are not necessarily trying to maximize happiness. People might choose to trade off happiness against other factors, whether that's having a family or a more fulfilling career, and people should be entitled to make these choices. So policymakers shouldn't impede them. I would really like to emphasize that this has implications for how we should govern society. It's not about trying to measure something on a survey and then say that people who aren't striving towards this particular survey question are doing something wrong, or that we should sacrifice other objectives in support of that. We should let people make their own choices, and an increase in happiness is not an overriding objective necessarily.
Joshua, thank you so much for your time.
Great to talk to you.
Joshua Gottlieb is a professor of economics at the University of British Columbia. He co-authored the study, Unhappy Cities.
A whole lot of loving is what we'll be bringing. We'll make you happy.
Project Happy sounds like code for an undercover operation to bring more joy to the nation's unhappiest cities. While it may not have such a wide-ranging effect, Project Happy in New York City brings a whole lot of joy to everyone involved. The program at Hunter College in Manhattan provides activities for youth with disabilities. Penny Shaw is the project director of Project Happy. She's in the studio with us this morning. Penny, thanks so much for being here.
You're very welcome.
So tell me about Project Happy.
Well, Project Happy is a sports program at Hunter College. It's designed for people who have disabilities, generally young people under the age of 25.
How long has it been in operation?
We opened our doors in January of 1981.
Who was the brainchild, you?
Well, no, I wasn't the brainchild. I was the facilitator, let's say. The brainchild was the chairman of my department. That was then the Department of Health and Physical Education at Hunter College, a fellow by the name of Dr. Burke. He was our chair, and he got the first grant to do this program. He actually had a child with a disability. That was his inspiration. But it never got off the ground. There was a grant and an idea. And then he grabbed me one day and said, don't you have leadership abilities? Don't you run a parents association, a block association? And I said, sure. He said, you want to try this? And I said, I'll try it. And I did. And I'm still there.
Talk to me about how this program helps the individuals who are taking part in it.
Well, most of the people in our program would be sitting at home on a Saturday watching TV or basically watching TV or playing video games now. We didn't have that in the beginning. When I started the program in 1981, we didn't have curb cuts, for instance. So if you were in a wheelchair, you couldn't even get out. You couldn't get across the street without a lot of help. There were no accessible buses. There was no way for anyone to get around if they had a disability. So we were able to hire buses and bring children in the beginning, and that worked really well. It gives them a chance to spend the Saturday just the way every other child spends their Saturday, what we take for granted with our own children. And I was taking for granted with my own children until I saw this enormous problem. It's a lot better now because there are accessible buses, there are curb cuts, there are laws that insist that everybody be treated equally, thank goodness. So there are now other programs. When we opened our doors in 1981, there were no other programs for the kind of population that we were serving.
How much has your program grown over the years?
Just like everything else, I don't really know the economy, but I think it's about 10 times. We started with about 10 or 15 youngsters, 4 or 5 volunteers who were Hunter students. We are now, our roster of students, our roster of participants, that is people with disabilities in the program, is at about 150, and our volunteer list is about the same.
What kinds of disabilities do these individuals have?
The disabilities pretty much run the gamut. In each case, however, they're at the high functioning end of the disability. So we have children with autism, for instance, but they've all been screened and they do pretty well. They won't function in a normal program, but they can play all the games that we do and they all learn to swim. We have people who use wheelchairs, but are typical in every other way. We have youngsters who have retardation, and we have some combinations of those disabilities, because just because you have one doesn't mean you're not going to get another one right on top of it.
What kinds of games do you play?
Well, we're really an instructional program. So we do play games, but for instance, we have a very extensive swim program. Most of our children, especially the ones in the autism spectrum who people never thought could swim, learn to swim. It's a very strictly organized swim program. Did you know that drowning is a major cause of death among people with autism because it's coupled with wandering? So it's our mission, really, to save lives. So this is not just fun. This is serious stuff. We have wheelchair basketball, for instance. But there's a coach. It's not just kids playing around. And we have lots of volunteers who actually will get into the wheelchairs and play with the youngsters. We have a dance group. We have a little theater there. And they do some choreography. They do some aerobics. It's all skill-oriented. Now, we do play a little volleyball and badminton and whatnot and some bowling type of games. But mostly, we're skill-oriented.
How have you seen this change the lives of the people who take part in these programs?
Oh, it's an amazing thing to see in some cases. I'm not saying all cases, but in many cases. For instance, a parent wrote to me recently saying her child would not be returning. Oh, sad, I think. And then I read the rest of the email. You know, Nicholas feels that he can now join a regular baseball team. And so we're putting him into a group with typical children. Well, he gained some skills with us, gained confidence. He doesn't have to lie down on the baseball field kicking and screaming if something goes wrong. So that's a really wonderful feeling. I'm not saying that happens with all the children or even many of the children, but when it happens, it's a really nice feeling. So now let's go back to the swimming thing, because that's a real pet of mine. In the summer, a parent called me and said, we took our child to the beach and there was a pool and he was the only one who could swim. So here you have a child in the autism spectrum who is usually marginalized because of his disability. And there he is swimming laps and everybody's saying, whoa, you know, or a youngster in a wheelchair who goes into the onto the basketball court in a marginal neighborhood, say, and throws the basketball into the basket again and again. And everyone stands back and says, wow, there's nothing wrong with him. You know, so in that way, building confidence is great. It really is great if they get really good at a skill. So all kinds of things like that happened.
The program no doubt makes people happy, but the HAPPY in Project HAPPY is actually an acronym, right?
Yes, it is. And I did not invent that acronym. It stands for Hunter Activity Program for Parents and Youth. I think it was very clever and we've kept it. Sometimes I think it's silly, but lots of people, the parents sometimes call it the HAPPY Project. But everyone is smiling. And when I bring people in to look at the program, possible donors or whatever, friends, they can't believe that these children who have pretty serious disabilities have these big smiles on their faces. And if you look at our website, you'll see smile after smile after smile. And it's not that we selected those pictures. It's that it's pretty much the picture. They're happy to be there. Also, the parents are smiling because they're getting a little break.
Penny, thank you so much for coming in.
You're very welcome.
That was Penny Shaw of Project HAPPY. You can learn more about the organization at project-happy.org. Because I'm happy. Clap along if you feel like a room without a roof. You're listening to Cityscape on 90.7 FM and WFUV.org. Good morning once again. I'm George Boldarkey. Pharrell's song, Happy, swept the country as one of the summer's biggest hits. Inspired by the musical phenomenon, Jeffrey Stevens used the song to create a series of one-take music videos showcasing New York City hotspots. He's on the phone with us this morning. Jeffrey, thanks for taking the time.
Great to be here today, George. Thanks for having me.
So tell me about this project, Happy in New York City.
It started back in late January of this year. I had sort of seen the original Pharrell video around the holidays, and I love the original project so much. And as I was watching all the individual videos on the website, I kind of noticed that the whole city of LA was a character in the videos, and I kind of felt inspired to want to do something like that but feature New York. And I was kind of coming up with ideas, and I had kind of been through like a really traumatic year. My mom had passed away like very suddenly, and this song was sort of something I listened to a lot during the holidays to kind of cheer me up. And I knew it was a song that she would have loved. I wanted to come up with some kind of a project where I could collaborate with other people. I knew a lot of talented comedians and actors and improvisers in the city. And also, I don't know, sort of do something to sort of honor my mom and her memory. So I started emailing friends, people I knew at the end of January. And I said, I want to, you know, shoot these 4-minute, one-take music videos all around the city. You can pick the location, and as long as someone hasn't done it already, I'll meet you there day or night, inside, outside, wherever. And it was also kind of funny because it was really, really cold that time of year in New York. And, the, you know, the original Pharrell video, it's, you know, beautiful, it's warm, it's sunny. So I thought that that kind of added an extra layer of kind of comedy to it with people dancing, you know, just in the middle of New York in the dead of winter.
So tell me more about some of the backdrops that you used for these videos.
I started out, I emailed maybe about 30 people. A few people got back to me. We started making a few. And after the, I started posting them up individually. I was just going to originally shoot maybe 20, edit them all together over like a 2-week period and be done with it. But once I started posting a couple of them, I sort of put my contact information at the end. I started getting emails from other friends, friends of friends, and then a lot of people I had never met before. And pretty soon it kind of snowballed into something that took over my life for about 2.5 months.
How many videos did you create in total?
I shot 125, if you can believe it.
Wow. How varied were the locations?
We were all over the place. We never really got permission to shoot anywhere. It was very rogue. And I was pretty much a one-man music video-making crew. I had this portable speaker that I'd wear around my neck with a lanyard. I plugged my iPod into that. It was pretty loud. I had, like, a camera, like a Steadicam-type device to get, like, that smooth shot. And we'd, you know, pick a spot and just go. And I knew if we were shooting somewhere in a subway or indoors somewhere, like I think we shot one in Port Authority, all these different subways. And I knew it's only 4 minutes. So before anyone even knows what's happening, the video is already done. And I would tell everyone, this is it. We get one take. We're not stopping. Once we go, we're going. And I'm walking backwards the whole time, so I can't even really see where I'm going. I sort of look back right before we start, map out a route, and it's like, all right, if I crash into something, let's just keep going.
So just how varied are the characters and the action in all of these videos?
First off, it was a lot of actors and a lot of comedians were doing it at first. A lot of people from the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater got involved. A new theater nearby in Prospect Heights called G-Square. Had a bunch of great dancers who wanted to get involved. And it was actually one of the girls who was in the original video saw it and who had recently moved to New York, got in touch with me, and so she actually got to be in both videos.
Jeffrey, anything particularly funny or odd happen while on a shoot?
We had some run-ins with security. Cops never bothered us, ever. It was always just security guards. So one time I was shooting one with he's a drummer with the symphony at Lincoln Center. And so we started the video like in the basement of Lincoln Center in the percussion room. We sort of worked our way through Lincoln Center, and for the last minute we were finishing up outside by the big fountain. And some security guard saw us, and he just starts chasing after us, yelling at us. And we just kind of pick up our pace. And by the end, the guy I was filming was sort of doing a half-running, half-dancing move. And we're sort of evading the security guy. And we finish just in time before he runs over to us. You know, and he starts yelling at us to get out of here. We don't have permission. What are we doing? And the guy I was filming, he's like, no, it's okay. Like, I'm in the orchestra here. I work here. It's all right. And that actually made the security guard angrier. He's like, oh, you made me chase after you and do all this. Like, oh, get out of here. So we had some run-ins with security. We were filming one out in front of the Apollo on 125th Street. We were just passing by the Apollo on the sidewalk. And the security guard, just as we were walking by under the awning, like totally grabbed me and kind of clubbed my camera. And he had this walkie-talkie in his hand and like smashed into the lens. And for a second, I thought the camera broke. It was so hard. But it didn't, and we just kept going. And I just sort of yelled at the guy, and I told the girl who was dancing, like, keep going, keep going.
Of all the videos that you've made, of all the happy videos, do you have a favorite?
I have a bunch. I mean, I was able to shoot one with my older brother, my sister-in-law, and they had my nephew's was about maybe a year at that time. So I was able to film them in Prospect Park. And it's the kind of thing, you shoot it, it goes by in a flash, you're exhausted by the end. People don't realize, like, dancing for 4 minutes while walking forward, like, in front of a camera it's a full-on workout. Like, people are, like, gasping for air at the end of 4 minutes.
Jeffrey, what do you want viewers of these videos to take away?
I kind of want them to, sort of appreciate the city. I was shooting a lot of these videos. An interesting part of it, rewatching them for me, I don't even watch the dancers sometimes. I like to just look at the people, the bystanders who are walking around or in the background, like their reaction to it. And it was amazing how positive it was. People would want to join in, sometimes they join in for a minute, sometimes for the whole video. People would just get so excited once they realized what we were doing. And we shot one on Bedford Avenue in Williamsburg, like during a snowstorm. And we were just kind of going from North 6th to North 7th, this really great actor and dancer, her name's Julia Kelly. And once we started filming, she was a little shy at first before we started. And she said, I'm not really, much of a dancer. I was like, that's okay. I was telling her, do whatever you want. Don't get nervous. Just have fun with it. As soon as the music started, she started going crazy. She was doing all these dance moves, and she got everyone. It was like a really crowded sidewalk. She got everyone walking by or that we passed to, like, join her. And, in the last minute, this big group of, like, school kids came up from behind, and it almost looked like we had planned it out. But it just happened. But I couldn't have planned it, more perfectly.
We should point out that you do have a television production background, right?
I do. I work with my older brother. We shoot a TV show for CBS, the CBS Sports Network, where we chronicle college football tailgating all around the country. So I do have a little experience with manning a camera and editing and all that kind of stuff.
Where does the Happy in New York City video series live now?
It has its own website. I created back when I, about a week into it, once I realized it was getting kind of popular, I had a Tumblr, and then I created the website. It's happynyc.com.
Clap along. Right,
yep,
Jeffrey?
You can go back. You can watch all the individual videos. And then I made a super cut of all the ones I shot in February and then another one of all the ones I shot in March and April.
Jeffrey, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
That was Jeffrey Stevens. You can find his project online at happynyc.com.
I'm happy knowing that you are mine.
In the hustle and bustle of New York City, it's easy to get caught up in the mundane, to forget to take the time to smile in the face of our daily routines, like riding the subway, for instance. For Improv Everywhere, spreading joy is part of their official description. Founder Charlie Todd is on the phone with us this morning. Charlie, thanks for taking the time.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
So you're the folks behind the annual No Pants subway ride, correct?
Yes. Improv Everywhere has been around New York since summer of 2001, and among many of the projects we do is the annual No Pants Subway Ride.
What's the ultimate goal of Improv Everywhere?
Well, our goal is to cause scenes of chaos and joy in public places. And by chaos, I mean something that is unexpected, something that breaks from the normal routine of city life. And by joy, I mean that we're hoping to make people laugh and smile. Although our projects are most frequently unauthorized, our goal is not to anger anyone or embarrass anyone or do any of the things that you would normally associate with a prank or a practical joke. Instead, we're trying to do things that are going to inject comedy into the city.
How did Improv Everywhere come about?
It got started when I moved here after college. I was a theater major, and I took up here with an interest in improv comedy and theater. And while I was starting to pursue that, I started taking classes at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater pretty early on. But as I was sort of getting my foot in the door of that world, I was a little frustrated at the lack of opportunities to perform in terms of, you know, theater. So I just started doing things in public spaces. And it was very small at first. I mean, the very first No Pants Subway Ride was just myself and six buddies. So it grew slowly over the years to the point of it being a bit ridiculous. This past year, we had over 4,000 people participating in the No Pants Subway Ride here in New York.
Now, you call it Improv Everywhere, but what you do is not spontaneous. There's a lot of planning that's involved.
Yeah, Improv Everywhere is a bit of a misnomer. If I could go back in time and change the name, I probably would. The word improv makes some sense in our name because we don't know exactly how people are going to react to us. You know, we're doing things we often don't have permission to be doing, and we're creating a surprise moment in the world that people will react to in unpredictable ways. So there is a bit of improvisation to the madness. But we also spend lots and lots of time organizing these projects, so they are often highly choreographed and very much planned in advance. So the word improv certainly confuses people sometimes.
You recently turned a very hot subway station into an unauthorized luxury spa. Tell us about that mission.
Yeah, so that project was called the Subway Spa. I used to live in Astoria, Queens, and I have lots of memories of waiting for the train at the MQR platform on 34th Street, which I believe is the hottest in the system, or it's the hottest one that I'm familiar with. So we decided that it would be fun to take a place that is pretty miserable. People are generally pretty unhappy when waiting for a train on that platform in the middle of July, and turn it into something positive and try to make the best of it. So we set up a spa. We had a big table with giant containers of ice water that we handed out. We had towels that we handed out to people. And then I also had a group of actors, about a dozen or so people, dressed in towels, walking around, treating the subway benches as if they were benches in a sauna. And then finally, we had a misting station where we had a few people acting as employees of the spa who were misting down with bottles of water, both our actors and then also any commuters who were interested in getting a bit of mist, which was quite a few, actually. The main difference in style between a lot of the candid camera projects and Improv Everywhere projects is we often don't have a reveal moment. So at the end of the day, there's no announcement. Hey, this is all done for a hidden camera project. There's the camera right there. Let's smile and clap. Instead, what we do is disappear back into the city.
Charlie, thanks so much for your time.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Charlie Todd is the founder of Improv Everywhere. You can find out more about his organization at improveverywhere.com. And that's all the time we have for today. If you want more Cityscape, you can hear past episodes in our archives at wfuv.org/cityscape. I'm George Bodarkey. My thanks to producer Taylor Nolk. Have a great weekend.
Smile, though your heart is aching. Smile, even though it's breaking. When there are clouds in the sky.
It's WFUV and WFUV HD, New York. Listener-supported public media from Fordham, the Jesuit University of New York. Music discovery starts here.